Welcome to the Deep Dive. We help you get informed fast, taking sources and turning them into, well, hopefully, a fascinating conversation. Today, we're digging into the theme, Stamps Tell Stories. And oh boy, do we have a story. It spans about 150 years, involves a tiny island, a really ambitious tycoon, and some printing plates that went missing for decades.
Yeah, it's quite the saga.
Our mission today is to trace the journey of the original printing forms for stamps from Helgoland, which used to be a British crown colony. These aren't just old bits of metal. They got tangled up in some pretty intense 19th century business deals, legal fights that actually shaped stamp collecting, and then, well, a much darker chapter involving Nazi theft.
And what's just incredible is that these actual plates, the physical objects, survived it all. They vanished after World War II, basically. But thanks to some really dedicated research, years of it, they've been returned to the descendants of the guy who bought them way back, almost 150 years ago.
And they're actually coming up for auction soon, right? September 2025.
That's right. It's amazing. These plates, you could call them witnesses of time. They really show you that intersection of commerce, law, and, yeah, some very dark history.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. The man behind a lot of this drama, Julius Goldner, born in Hamburg, 1842, he wasn't your typical shopkeeper. From the 1860s, he was a massive stamp wholesaler. Think big business, bulk buys, professional trading on a large scale.
He really was a powerhouse in that era. I mean, his portfolio tells the story. 1868, he buys up the entire remaining stock of the old Prussian Postal Administration. Then he gets all the remainders of Hamburg's first and second stamp issues. He's working with the big international names, too, like Stanley Gibbons, Jean-Baptiste Moens, and Brussels.
So he's cornering the market on these stamps that aren't used for postage anymore but are super collectible.
Exactly. He saw the potential early.
But it seems his business sense maybe walked a fine line ethically, even early on.
Well, yeah. The sources suggest he was bending the rules pretty quickly, even before Helgoland really kicked off. As early as 1869, we see him getting original, unused stamps and official cancellation devices from a postal guy in Hamburg.
And what did he do with them?
He started applying backdated postmarks, making them look like they'd been genuinely posted and used.
Ah, to increase the value, because used ones were scarcer.
Precisely. So he's manipulating the evidence, the provenance, for profit. It kind of sets the stage, doesn't it?
It does. A shrewd operator, maybe a bit unscrupulous, in a market that was, well, booming but not really regulated yet. Which brings us to Helgoland, tiny British island, but with these really distinctive stamps.
And the printing process was quite something, wasn't it? Not straightforward.
No, not at all. It was complex. A two-stage method. They used letterpress for the stamp's frame, and then embossing for the queen's head in the middle.
So you needed two different plates for each stamp.
Exactly. Two plates. And that becomes important later. Okay, so Helgoland changes currency, switches to the German mark, and their old shilling stamps become obsolete, demonetized, in February 1875.
Right. And Goldner, always thinking ahead, snaps up the entire remaining stock of those shilling stamps in January 75, just before they were officially invalid.
He's got the stamps, but clearly he senses the demand is bigger than his stock. He needs more.
He did. And you have to remember the context back then. Nudrik reprints made from the original plates were seen by many collectors as, well, perfectly acceptable. Especially if the originals were really expensive. It wasn't automatically seen as fraud unless you tried to pass them off as originals that had actually been used for postage.
So he tries to just order more.
He does. He goes straight to the top, the Berlin Reichsdruckerei, the Imperial Printing Office in February 75. But they basically said, hang on, you're a private citizen. We can't just print official stamps for you. Which makes sense.
So he needed a workaround, an official channel.
Exactly. And he uses connections. He knew Helgoland's postmaster, Dr. Robert Pilger. Pilger then officially commissioned the reprints on Goldner's behalf in March 1875.
Ah, so that's the official link.
Sort of. That's why this first batch gets called the Berliner Nudruck. They were, let's say, officially mediated private reprints. Printed officially, but really for Goldner's business.
Okay, that's clever. But then he takes it a step further in 1879, a big step.
Oh, yeah. The game changer. He thinks, why mediate? Why not just own the means of production? So, in January and September 1879, he legally buys the original printing forms. All of them. Stamps, postcards, envelopes, wrappers, everything.
He bought the actual tools.
The actual tools. And the sales contracts were crystal clear. They gave Goldner the explicit right to produce and sell Nudruck using these original plates.
And he didn't hold back, did he?
Not at all. The sources say millions of these reprints flooded the market, produced well into the 1890s.
But this kind of industrial-scale reprinting from official plates, even if legal by contract, must have raised eyebrows.
It certainly did. By 1888, there's a new governor in Helgoland, Sir Arthur Cecil Stuart Barclay. He takes one look at this massive private operation, churning out official reprints via the imperial printer, and says, absolutely not. He shuts down that arrangement.
Cuts off his access to the Berlin Reichsdruckerei.
Right. But Goldner doesn't just stop.
Of course not.
He just moves the operation. This kicks off what collectors call the print shop carousel. First stop, Leipzig. He gets the firm Giesecke and Devrient to print for him. These become known as the Leipziger Neutrik.
And these are different how? Still from the original plates?
Still from the original plates, yes. But crucially, there's no longer any official postmaster involved. No mediation. So these are purely private reprints. Huge quantities. Nobody knows exactly how many.
And then he moves again.
One more time, in 1891. To Hamburg, using F. Schlotke & Co. This seems to have been mostly about logistics. Shipping heavy, delicate printing plates back and forth was a pain. Having the printing done right there in Hamburg, where he was based, was just easier.
So this constant stream of reprints, first mediated, then purely private, it must have caused uproar among collectors. This Nachdruck Unwesen, the reissue mischief, as they called it.
Absolutely. Protests grew louder and louder through the 1880s and 90s. Goldner's relentless commercial drive was basically forcing the philatelic world and the legal system to figure out what was what.
It's fascinating how this whole thing hinges not just on the stamps, but the tools used to make them, the plates themselves. So when it finally ends up in court in 1894, what were the key definitions they were trying to pin down?
This is really the legacy of the Affair Goldner. It forced everyone to get clear on the terms, and these definitions pretty much stuck. Okay, first, Neudruck. The reprint, that's a print from the original, completely unchanged plate, but made after the stamp, was no longer valid for postage.
Okay, so the stuff Goldner printed from the plates he bought in 79, that fits the Neudruck definition.
Correct. As long as the plates weren't altered. Then there's Nachdruck. A reissue, or maybe reprint, is a close translation. This could be a print from an original plate that had been repaired or altered in some way. Or, importantly, from a completely new printing tool designed to look like the original.
Ah, a new tool. That sounds like a key difference.
It is. And that leads to the third term, Fälschung, counterfeit, which is what Goldner was actually put on trial for in 1894.
So wait. He was printing millions of Neudruck from the plates he legally owned. That wasn't what got him sued.
No, not directly. The lawsuit was triggered because it turned out, back in 1879, he hadn't actually received every single piece of printing material related to the Helgoland issues. There were some gaps, maybe some specific values or types of plates were missing. So what did Goldner do?
Let me guess. He just made new ones.
He commissioned them. He had additional printing stocks and plates manufactured to replicate the originals he didn't have.
Okay, that sounds like crossing a line. Creating new tools to mimic official ones.
That's what the prosecution argued. That this commissioning of new tools constituted Fälschung.
And the verdict.
Here's the twist. He was acquitted.
Acquitted. Even though he commissioned new plates.
He was. The legal standards, or maybe the evidence presented back then, led to acquittal. But, and this is crucial looking back, experts agree today that those commissioned editions absolutely would be classified as Fälschung, as counterfeits, by modern standards. So while he walked free, the trial itself, the whole controversy, was fundamental. It forced the philatelic world to draw these lines, to define these terms legally for the first time.
That's a huge legacy, even from an acquittal.
Hmm.
Before we get to the 20th century, there's one other type of reprint to mention, right? A very different kind.
Yes, a small but significant exception. In 1890, the German Reich Post Administration itself decided it wanted examples of the Helgoland stamps for its own museum, the Reichspost Museum. So they commissioned their own set of reprints, purely official ones, a tiny run, just 200 examples of each value, specifically for the museum collection.
Wow, only 200.
Extremely limited. And interestingly, these purely official museum reprints are often way more valuable today than Goldner's mass-produced ones, sometimes even more than the original used stamps themselves.
It really shows that the authority behind the printing matters just as much as the plate itself.
Exactly. Provenance and authority are key.
Okay, now the story takes a darker turn. We move into the 20th century. Julius Goldner dies in 1898.
Right, and his son, John Goldner, takes over the business. And he runs it quite successfully for decades.
Until
the Nazis came to power in early 1933. The Goldner family was Jewish, and like countless others, they immediately faced persecution. Growing restrictions, economic pressures, running the business became impossible.
This was part of the systematic targeting and expropriation of Jewish assets.
Yes. By late 1938, the state appointed two trustees whose job was explicitly to liquidate the Goldner stamp business, seize the assets. In March 1939, John Goldner himself was declared a foreigner, stripped of rights, and thankfully managed to emigrate with his family. They went to Mexico.
And the business, his family's legacy, was effectively dismantled and seized by the state.
Correct.
What about the plates? The very Helgoland printing plates that Julius had bought back in 1879. They were part of the company's assets.
They were. But the authorities didn't initially see them as valuable historical artifacts because of the past controversy and the trial.
They saw them as tools for counterfeiting.
Exactly. They were officially declared falsifications or tools for falsification. Initially, they were just handed over to the Hamburg State Police, potentially for destruction.
Oh, no. They could have been lost forever right there.
They easily could have been. But thankfully, a well-known collector intervened, Captain Walter Sass, who specialized in Helgoland. He somehow persuaded the authorities of their historical, if not monetary, significance. In August 1939, instead of being destroyed, the confiscated plates and related stocks were transferred to the Reichspost Museum in Berlin.
The same museum that had commissioned its own tiny run of reprints years earlier, saved by a collector's intervention.
A crucial moment. But then, after World War II, things got murky.
How so? They were in the museum, right?
They were, but their specific identity as ex-Goldner property, as items expropriated from a Jewish family under duress, kind of got lost. The museum had other Helgoland material. Documentation was maybe chaotic after the war. The specific provenance of these plates as looted assets wasn't clearly tracked or acknowledged for a long time. The trail went cold within the museum's own collection.
So they were hidden in plain sight, in a way.
For decades, yes. Until 2015, the museum, which is now the Museum for Communication, launched a major research project specifically looking into items with problematic Nazi-era provenance. Researchers had to painstakingly reconstruct the paper trail from 1938 and 39, the seizure by the trustees, the police involvement, Saxe's intervention, the transfer records. It was serious historical detective work.
To prove these specific items were the ones taken from the Goldners.
Precisely. And they did it. They identified over 300 stocks, including these legendary printing plates, as having been expropriated from the Goldner family.
And the result of that research?
Restitution. Following the established principles for returning property looted during the Nazi era, the identified items, including the Helgoland plates, were returned to John Goldner's descendants, who are now in Mexico and the USA.
Wow. After all that time, it closes a loop that was open for, what, nearly 80 years?
An incredible resolution to that part of the story.
So let's wrap this up. Thinking about this whole journey for you, the listener, whether you're a collector or just interested in history, we followed these physical objects, these metal plates, through an absolutely epic 150-year story. They started as tools for money in a tiny colony.
Then became the engine of a private commercial empire built on a legal gray area.
Then they were evidence in a court case that actually helped define what's real and what's fake in stamp collecting.
Then confiscated as tools for falsification by the Nazis, saved from destruction, hidden in a museum.
And finally, identified through research and returned as family heritage. It's just incredible.
It really is. And I think the big takeaway from the Goldner affair is how even seemingly small, specialized things like printing plates can carry enormous historical weight. They teach us about philatelic history, sure, the definitions of Neudruck, Nachdruck, Fälschung, but they also physically embody this huge political tragedy of the 20th century. They survived it.
Which leaves us with a final thought, maybe a provocative question for you to consider.
Yeah, think about the values. You've got the original postally used stamps, then Goldner's first officially mediated reprints, then his purely private mass produce reprints, and then those super rare official museum reprints. The market prices for these are all over the place. So the question is, how do you or how should we truly value an object like these plates or even the stamps they printed when their significance isn't just about rarity, but about this incredibly complex history, a history that includes sharp business practices, legal ambiguity, and profound injustice? What's the real story these stamps tell?
That is definitely something to think about, an amazing story held within these objects. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.